Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where we hit work and money with a millennial twist and strive not to bore you to sleep.
I think you used that one before, brother, man. You're getting a little rusty.
Hey, man, I am recycling this week. All right, leave me alone. Let it go.
Hey, man, recycling is the millennial way. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at SoundCloud at Paychecks and Balances.
And if you're interested in having your side hustle or business promoted on the podcast without breaking the bank, visit paychecksandbalances.com/small business. 140 characters. If you visit the page, that'll make sense. Again, paychecksandbalances.com/small business.
So, folks, by the time you hear this, it will have been a while, but we're joined by another awesome guest. Mandy Woodruff is a personal finance expert with a special focus on millennial spending. She's also a former Yahoo personal finance reporter who's appeared as an on-camera expert for CBS.
Fancy.
Good Morning America.
Real fancy.
And many others. More recently, she's become executive editor at MagnifyMoney.com, a money columnist at Teen Vogue,
woo!
And co-host of the Brown Ambition podcast.
Yeah.
I feel like that woo was a little early, but we're happy to have her on the show for you, the people. Thanks for joining us, Ms. Woodruff.
Now, that was an introduction. Thank you. That was fantastic.
Yo, he was getting so bothered with me because I was like, yo, I think I'm going to throw in some ad-libs. He's like, really, brother? You trying to turn this into a hip-hop mixtape? I'm like, hey.
And so is there anything that you'd care to expand on that I didn't hit there for the people?
That was a nice walk down memory lane. Thank you. I am such a big fan of the show. I love you guys. I feel like we're like on opposite poles of the personal finance podcast world. And I love what you guys do. So thank you so much for having me. This is exciting.
Nice. All this flattery. I don't know what to do with myself.
Yeah, I definitely just did a 360 in my chair.
It was all the coffee I've had, you know.
Hey, yeah. That's all it takes. That's all it takes. People know that about me. And so why did you want to be in the writing and journalism world?
Oh, that's an easy question. I've never been good at anything else. So I was like, I'm going to have to make this work somehow. Yeah, I've always wanted to be a writer. That's just like the short story. And then when I had the fortune of getting into the University of Georgia's journalism school, which is the Grady School of Journalism, they're just brilliant. They are behind the Peabody Awards. Tons of brilliant journalists have come out of that school. And that's where I got started. And thank God it's worked out. I graduated in the thick of the recession.
Ooh.
So it's a miracle. I have a ton of friends. We always joke about this. We look around the table when we meet up and we're like, so how many of us are still in journalism? Like two, three, maybe three, because it was rough. It was tough to find work. A lot of people, you know, had to do what they had to do, but I'm very blessed and fortunate to have made it into a career that's, knock on wood, still happening.
Nice, nice.
So I have to ask, without dating yourself, so however you go about answering this question, which recession are you referring to?
Oh, the 2007-08.
Okay.
Crisis, okay. Financial crisis. I'm cool with dating myself.
Hey, I'm
in the middle of planning my 30th birthday. I'm really, it's 6 months away, but that's fine. I'm thinking about it already.
Oh, nice. So yeah. Well, one, congrats. And then two, you're like true mid-millennial.
Yeah. I'm like, I don't know. I'm getting married next month. I feel like I've been repping for the older millennial lately. I found myself saying a lot, you know, can we just stop saying millennial and then putting a picture of a 22-year-old eating pizza at a frat party in the article? Because that's not really who all of us are anymore. I feel like a lot of us are, I think, you know, on the other side now where we don't need so much advice on like how to budget. But now it's like, what do I do with this 401k? And like, can I afford a kid? And where the hell am I going to live? And a house? What's that about? You know, that kind of stuff. I'm there. That's where I'm at.
Awesome. And so I'm curious, when you got into journalism post-graduation, I think print was still kind of being or starting to be phased out then or in the thick of it. Of course, there's still a lot of print publications out there. But did you ever think about whether you wanted to be more in print versus digital? Because there are some folks who go from blogger to writer or
right.
You know, they make some other type of transition. So were you at all worried or did you have any thoughts as you were coming out and you're like, all right, I want to be more featured online versus more print?
It's funny because I majored in magazines. So that tells you how far behind we were at the school.
I didn't even know that was a major. I've never heard of magazines.
It's no longer a major. Thank goodness. Finally, I was like, when are they going to drop this whole? Because at my journalism school, the broadcast kids were in their major, and then you had the print kids in their major, and the radio in their major, and the PR in their major. And now it's like, you have to be able to do everything. So you see a lot more journalism schools now doing more of a holistic approach. Like, because right now I write, I edit, I do video, I run a podcast now. Like, when did I ever, I didn't learn those skills in school. I was completely unprepared for the digital revolution of news. But what I was prepared in, luckily, from that school was journalism. I mean, I knew how to tell a story. I knew how to tell a factual story, you know, all those skills. And thank goodness I adapted. You had to be really quick to adapt. My first foray into personal finance journalism was with Business Insider, which was at the time just brand new, baby Business Insider. And now it's just massive. But they were launching a PF section. And one of my former colleagues from an internship I had done years before that, the only way that she knew that I might be good for that job is not because she's like, oh, Mandy, she's great with money. Because no, I was awful at it. It's because I had started a blog on the side. I used to blog about biking in New York. Real cool. I know.
That's cool. That's got some cred to it. That's like literal street cred. You're out there on the street.
It's pretty well known. I don't mean to brag, but I did get recognized one time on a bike tour in New York.
I thought you were going to say by like Schwinn or one of the bike makers.
More like a random girl on a ferry one time. But so I had this bike blog, and that was my experience writing for the web. And I started telling fun stories about the culture of biking in New York. And anyway, she saw that. She's like, I like your writing style. It's not about money, but come in and interview for this job. And I was like, I don't know anything about personal finance, except I would like more money. And I felt like I had missed all the lessons. I felt like I was in the real world and I had missed out on something. Like there was a course I'd missed out on and I had no idea what I was doing. And I got laid off my first job in New York and I literally had like a mattress and a brand new iPhone, which I had no business owning. And I had to figure it out. And so I went into this interview and I just faked it until I made it. And I don't even know. I don't remember what I said. I was like, Susie Orman, that Dave Ramsey, I want to do this, please. Dear, just hire me. Yeah, thankfully it worked out. And Business Insider, back to your question, digital, sorry, I went all over the place. But Business Insider was like at the forefront of writing for the web and headlines and photos and packaging stories. And they're the reason why I feel like I succeeded, is because I brought all the tools I had from, you know, journalism school. And then I melded those with the skills that BI taught me about capturing people on the internet.
Nice, nice. So I found that for a lot of people, losing their job, getting laid off is the big turning point that then puts them on the path to whatever it is that they really want to do. So, I mean, I guess it was pretty early on for you, but did you have any of that? I guess in retrospect, are you like, oh man, that was the best thing that ever happened, losing my job?
Oh, it was terrible. No. No,
actually,
there was like
the worst thing that ever happened.
No, I mean, I don't want to, you know, there's no fairy tale about it. I mean, I moved to New York for this job. It was with Reader's Digest at a magazine. So I was literally living the dream that I thought, you know, I went to school for magazines. I'm going to be a magazine writer. I got hired at Reader's Digest and I was going to work my way up, you know, and 2 months later, the company laid off 10% of its staff and they were nice, kind enough to give me a teeny tiny severance package, which they didn't have to do. I was barely there long enough to have earned anything. And I spent that summer like doing odds and end jobs and fighting with the Department of Labor in New York to get unemployment benefits. And I remember it was right before my birthday that August, because I was laid off in June and I had just paid rent for August. And I was like, that is the last of my money. Ooh. And if I don't get a paycheck, I have to go back to Georgia with my tail between my legs. And I applied for everything. And I finally got hired as a news assistant, which was like 4 steps down from what I had been doing before as a reporter. Mm. And my job was to help reporters find stories. I was like a story finding machine for a lovely legal news website, not glamorous at all. And I spent like 15 miserable months there. But one thing I did over that time was, you know, how it sort of all comes together is, like I said, broke, feeling like I missed out on some lesson. Why am I so broke? Why is this happening to me? Blah, blah, blah. Started educating myself and getting curious about money. And while I was at that job, was so bored by what I was doing, but rather than just sort of, you know, I don't know, just going through the motions, I started my bike blog. And I kept writing and I kept doing what I loved. And like I said, that's what got me the interview at Business Insider 15 months later. So yeah, I was sort of struggling, but it did sort of force me to be entrepreneurial in a way and create my own opportunities to write about what I wanted to. And, you know, it worked out eventually, but no, it wasn't like, it wasn't this aha moment of this is what I meant to do. It was like, oh crap, I got to survive, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And the entrepreneurial thing seems to be real big amongst the millennial cloud. There's also a lot of ambition, no pun to the podcast name, but yo, you've accomplished a lot of stuff by age 30. I'm not sure if you've noticed that at all. I mean, and just even in hearing Marcus's intro, I'm kind of like, wow, that is a lot. And then you're like, oh yeah, you know, I'm 30. I'm like, what have I been doing with my life?
Oh, stop it.
You know, even though it's only the difference of 3 years, I'm 33, will be 34 soon. But I guess looking back, I guess, what would you say the biggest things you were thinking about when you were getting started versus the biggest things that you have to think about now? So kind of the challenges back in the day to what are the challenges that you kind of the main challenges that you're facing now?
Challenges back then, it was the challenge was just, you know, how do I do this job at this legal site that paid me like I took a $10,000 pay cut for that job. And I already was making like not that much. I think I was making the low 30s at this job. And it was just like, how do I make the money? How do I make the numbers add up? How do I afford rent each month? And it was around that time at that job, because I was earning so little, that I would start putting a little bit on my credit card here and there and start racking it up. And so that was probably the challenge then, is like every month, how do I make the balance sheet add up? Mm. Now, I think the pressure as you get older and you become more successful, and what I'm experiencing like right now more than ever, is the power of lifestyle inflation. And I don't think people talk about that enough.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait a second.
Yes.
I'm making significantly more money now. I'm doing good. Why do I still feel broke sometimes?
Oh, man.
And I realize, so, well, yeah, right. More money, more problems, right?
Yeah. Can you elaborate on some? Because the reason we're getting all excited because we hit that topic a few times.
Just like 2 weeks ago, even.
But what are some of the specific lifestyle inflation that you've had?
Sorry to go back down that. But I think I'm glad you guys have talked about it, because it's so easy, right? I mean, you think, well, I got this raise. I'm finally going to get the apartment that's a dishwasher. I'm finally going to get the apartment that has a washer dryer. And oh, I got to have a car. Got to get married. Got to have a wedding. It's really easy for the expenses to start piling up. And you know, my fiance always tells me, you know, you worry too much. But I constantly sort of have to go back to like Mandy 7, 8 years ago. And I was pretty happy, you know, earning that little money and like trying to sort of kind of get back to a place when I didn't need as much to be happy, you know, so that we can be saving more for the future. I'm constantly worried about how much am I saving. And I feel like it ebbs and flows, but I definitely feel like as you earn more, it's important to like try to save more at the same time and not just spend more. I think it's way easier to like, you keep saving your little 5 or 10%, but then you spend so much more and you're sort of like missing the opportunity to be also increasing your savings as you're increasing your earnings and your spending.
Nice. Nice.
Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it does.
It definitely does. Given because as soon as you said lifestyle inflation, my legs started shaking. I felt a bulge in my neck with a vein popping out because, you know, it's something that we've talked about where we all kind of, as we progress, we have this feeling of, all right, I should be able to do more. I've been working so hard. I deserve this. Or as I guess, yeah. You know, Olivia Pope, I earn this or earn me, whatever. I guess that doesn't really apply here, but anyway. But
yes, Fitz, yes.
But we have that feeling where as we're progressing along, we're doing better in life or in some aspect of life. So we feel like that should go throughout our life, finance, career. And have you ever had that feeling of, man, I should be further along? Or have you always been someone who's kind of like, you know, I'm right where I'm supposed to be in the journey?
I'm not risk averse, obviously. I love taking risks in my career. I've bounced around a lot. And I think that's important to take big risks with your career. And I think that's sometimes the only way to move up financially and then professionally as well. But I'm very risk averse when it comes to money in some ways. I don't like to lose it. So I, you know, over the last few years have been working really, really hard to save. And been just, you know, all in with my savings. And I've done really well. My 401k is looking nice. And my savings account had been nice. I had, you know, I could have quit my job and probably live for a couple of years without working. Nice. But then, yeah. But now it's getting to the point where you have to start dipping in for the big expenses. You know, do I want to buy a house? I don't know. I feel like I'm at a place like a lot of, you know, lowercase m millennials are in, where it's like,
lowercase.
And that, you know, that word, we all hate it, love, hate it. Where it's like, we're like a little bit afraid to make these big purchases that our parents made because we lived through that recession and saw them struggle with their houses and their mortgages and all that kind of stuff and the big weddings and, you know, all the kids and, you know, all the trappings of adulthood. And you're a little weary of it. You're afraid. You're like, should I be doing that? And am I risking what I worked so hard to get? by taking those leaps. So that's been my struggle. I mean, geez, it took me like 2 years for my fiance to convince me we needed to buy a car. And we really did need a car.
Even in New York, though?
Yeah, so this past month, we moved in with, so last May, I decided it would be a great idea because I was so nervous about, we had the wedding coming up and blah, blah, blah. I wanted to buy a house. And I was like, okay, I don't want to risk what we've saved so far. So why don't we move in with your parents? Like, that sounds like, duh, they live in New York because he's born and bred New Yorker. His parents are Dominicans, live in Inwood. They had room. His brother just moved out. And I was like, let's just move in with your parents for like the next year and save all this money that we're throwing away on rent. And we did that. And, you know, it was an experience. It was a learning experience. It was hard. It's really hard living with your future in-laws. Yeah. I don't know if either of you guys have had that experience.
No,
but
definitely not.
Yeah.
I tried to live with my own parents after college.
Oh. And
I think we both divorced from one another about 6 months in. So that didn't work out for either partnership on that end. So I can only imagine if it was in-laws.
Yeah. But so that was we left our beautiful apartment in Queens to go live there. And that's when I realized you can be loved too much. You can, love can push away. You know, his parents were lovely and they gave us a huge gift in letting us live there. And we really did turbocharge our savings for that time. But we had to get out of there. It just wasn't 7 months in. I was like, and we need to go. I can't. I'm losing my mind. So we decided to move. And Astoria, in that time that we left Astoria, my God, like rents went nuts.
Yeah.
The same kind of place we had when we left, we would have been paying like 50% more for. It was nuts. So we decided to move. And now we're in Jersey City, New Jersey, which is basically the Astoria of, I call it the other Astoria on the other side of the river, the Hudson River, which is how I, you know, deal with it.
Astoria East or whatever it would be.
Astoria West. Yeah.
There we go.
Just across the river. But moving here now, we have family in Inwood. We have all these friends on Long Island. We need a car. We, you know, just to get around. So that was a big deal to put money into a car. I almost had a heart attack. It's scary. But yeah. I think at a certain point, you know, lowercase m millennials, you do sort of have to take the baby step, but do it in a smart, educated way, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So I won't lie. As you were saying all of that, I imagined y'all living in the basement and going on one of those HGTV shows where suddenly you have $1 million for a house, even though you're living in a tiny spot now and struggling to get
all
by.
Those people, I don't know who they are. Yeah, it'd be like Mandy and Enrique Santos are living with their in-laws and desperately need to get out of their house. Mandy cannot stand to eat any more tostones. She's gained 20 pounds in 6 months. Like, that's how it would have been.
They have a modest budget of $1.5 million for their first starter home.
Do you know how many of those calculators I've used where you say, how much house can I afford? And it's like, oh, you can get a mortgage of $800,000. And I'm like, say what? I don't want that. Get away from it. I like want to throw the computer away. It's scary
because
these people will give you all this money to buy a house. You know, I feel like the recession, it's been, 10 years almost since the recession hit. I think people are getting a little more relaxed with lending.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's a scary thought. I think the biggest challenge as you get older with money is just being your own policeman. Like when you get a credit card with like what credit card? I got that Chase Sapphire card. It gave me like a $30,000 limit.
Oh.
And I'm like, what? And I have to tell myself, I mean, not that I would ever, ever max it out, but I know some people would. And it's like, you have to tell yourself, so this is my credit limit. Here's how much I can afford to pay each month. My actual limit is like $2,000. That's it. That's your budget. And that's hard because there's so much, I feel like, temptation, you know?
Yeah. I know Marcus knows a whole lot about that.
Man, I had to write that down. Your limit is not your budget.
Limit is not your budget.
Because I've definitely had the limit as the budget once. So the story that Rich is alluding to, and then I'm probably putting the show notes, because I actually forgot the title, but I spent $26,000 in a weekend. All right, I already had
in a weekend.
Yeah, in a weekend.
Yo, yeah, it was a good weekend.
Because you paid off all your student loan debt in one day.
No, I got a consolidation loan. I won't go into the whole story because some of the listeners already know about this. It's not about me, and they mailed it to me, which I thought was equally insane. That's just like the $30,000 credit limit, and like, you know, basically like the two little devils came up. Two devils. It was like,
I see what you're saying.
Hey,
yeah.
Man, you can make it rain. And then the second devil was like, or we could go to the club. Like, no one said put it in the bank. And so,
but those
like,
are the two options, either make it rain or go to the club.
I did a combination of both of those. And yeah,
with your consolidation loan.
Yeah, and I've bought a car and bought some rims. Anyway, I won't go into all the details. I'll put that in the show notes for the people. With that being said, that is a good segue. I'm a advice for lowercase millennials. So, I mean, you said something at the beginning of the show that I think is lost in a lot of these articles is just how wide a range it is of 18 to 34. Mm-hmm. So let's maybe cut that in half from 18 to 25 from these experiences that you have. Is there anything that you would share with those individuals that you had wish you had done differently when you got started?
It's hard to wish I'd done anything differently because everything kind of fell into place. One thing I would say is, when you're 18 to 22, well, definitely graduate from college. That's important. No matter what anyone says, that's definitely important. But
I'll let that go.
Oh, sorry. No shade. If that doesn't apply to you guys, no worries. But like, take risks with your career and don't be afraid to, because I feel like I hate to pretend like I've gotten better at this because I still struggle with, I think we all do, but you are constantly doubting everything and you're worried about what your next move is going to be. And you guys made my career sound all pretty in a bow, but you know, there's all this, we create a lot of anxiety around our, about what we're doing professionally. And I think, especially when I was younger, I was that girl, like with the resume padfolio at the career fair and the pinstripe pants I got at Kohl's and like, you know, just really overthinking it and trying to strategize. And I think if you take the weird job, you know, if it's all that's there and you don't really see how this job may lead you to the next one, sometimes you just got to take the chance and make it work. You know, after college, I went 6 months and traveled in the thick of the recession. I literally turned down a job. I'm glad I was this naive, though. I didn't know how bad the recession was until after the fact. But I did. I got a newspaper job. And then I was like, kind of not feeling this. I want to go travel in South America and like just go be free. And I did that. And it worked out. I mean, I came back. And I got that job that I had been offered 6 months, 8 months before. And then New York came calling. And along the way, everything I learned in that 6 months, and I wasn't just on the beach. I mean, I was working for a news site in South America, doing the news, writing, still kind of like playing with my profession, but in a, you know, in my own, on my own terms. And when I came back, it was a talking point for interviews. I think it made people interested. It was something unique. And I'm glad I was that, like, quote unquote, dumb, as my little brother told me at the time. He's my financial life coach. I'm glad I was that naive and kind of made that crazy move and whatnot. I know you wanted probably something different, but that's all I can think of is maybe don't worry so much and do the crazy things.
All we wanted was your insights. All we wanted was your insights.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Just keep it real. You know,
this someone right now is being like, okay, great. I'm going to go get all the tattoos.
Actually, I have several advice on that with the many tattoos I have. Hey, as long as it's under the shirt, get as many as you want. Don't go with the first neck tattoo is what I'm saying. Like,
not the forehead tattoo.
Work your way up to that, young savage. So as far as relationships and money go, how would you recommend single individuals need to change their financial thinking or habits as they move from I to we?
Oh, yeah, that's a struggle. I think now more than ever, people are, and especially young women, you know, I was just reading an article about how men over the last, since the recession, have been earning less and sort of the balance is shifting, more equitable earnings in the home. And I know I'm just speaking, you know, for hetero couples specifically. I, you know, don't mean to leave anyone out in that, but I think definitely women are earning more and we're more independent and we're more financially stable, which is a beautiful thing. I mean, I think why wouldn't you want two successful earners in a family? But I do think that that can create conflict for sure. And I think when you're in a couple relationship and you're coming into it with your own money and your own savings and you've got your career and you're established, it can be difficult to imagine the we. It can be difficult to like think, okay, I want to make this career move or I want to buy this, you know, big purchase, vacation, car, whatnot. And how does that impact someone else? That's difficult. And it takes time. I think, you know, I've been with my fiance for 5 years and it's taken time for us to get to a point where it's, we realize there's no point in splitting the check because like it's all the same
yeah.
at the end of the day. It really is. But I think what's important is it depends really where you're at in your relationship. But if you're getting into like the serious commitment thing, I think it's really important very early on to understand what their goals are financially, not like, you know, interviewing them like exhaustively, but just say, you know, what do you want to do? What do you see yourself? on the beach when you retire, with kids, with no kids, retiring early. Like, you need to know that, you know, do you want to buy a house next year? Is that important to you? Because everything that they want to do when you are together will impact you financially. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of putting your own like money on the line when you get in a relationship. And I think that if you don't have the same goals or you're not moving in the same direction, you're just going straight for like terrible time. Just it's nothing but struggle in your future. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think in some way we're somehow related because I too engaged in a relationship for 5 years. And when is your birthday?
Please tell me it worked out.
When's your birthday? I just want to see something.
Oh, August 6th.
Okay, never mind. We're not the same sign. I was gonna go mind blown and start playing the air horns and all of that stuff. But I'll save that for another time. So I know for us, for a while, we kind of had our accounts separate, and we still do have our accounts separate, but we have started that conversation about having a joint account and, you know, who pays for what and when do we pool the money together. So within your relationship, when did you all start really having the conversations about how money was going to be divvied up and it's time for us to stop splitting the check and stuff like that?
I think as soon as you decide to move in together, it has to happen then. I think you're kidding yourself if you think that you're not going to, like, you're going to have totally separate financial lives if you're sharing a household together. So we moved in together, and it sounds crazy to me now, but 2 years after we started dating, like, I can't believe that was like, we felt like we were ready then, but we did. And at that time, what we started doing was we did divvy up the rent. We divvied it up. It was very fair. You know, you earn X percent of the income, so you're going to pay X percent of the rent, and you earn less, so you're going to pay a little bit less. And that was fair. I mean, I was at the time a higher earner, and so I paid more and he paid less, and we would split everything else. And you know, after a while, I remember he was working to pay off a little, not a ton, but some credit card debt, and I was debt free. And I said, okay, you know, I feel you struggling to make these debt payments. I want to help you. So how about I take on more of the rent, and then you can put that money toward your debt? And we kind of just checked in with each other. There were definitely some arguments. It took a long time before he was comfortable, you know, showing his credit score and like the full picture of his like student loan debt and all that. But I think it's about trust. And I think if you have a solid trust, foundation of trust, then there really shouldn't be too many issues with opening up about your finances. Some things we did to help us was, yes, we started a joint savings account. We shared that and we put money into that joint savings account for traveling. I think at the time we were planning a vacation. Mm. And that's a good way. Tiffany and I in the podcast, sometimes we talk about how early in her relationship with her fiance now, she was like, you should open a travel account, you know, or a house account or something like that, a vacation account. In the back of her head, she's like, that's going to be for a house someday. We're just going to keep saving. And this is going to be a big purchase account for us. And it totally worked because they're about to buy a house.
Nice.
But I think it's nice in the early times to like go in on something together. You know, we're working toward a goal together and start that joint account, but still have your money, you know, separate. And we still do that to this day. We have our joint credit card. We have our own bank accounts. We have our own credit cards. But we both have an idea of what we're spending because I think that's how it should be. I don't think that there should be secrets financially at all in a relationship. You know, I just got a question. Have you guys got this question before from someone who's like, is it okay for me to have an emergency fund from our relationship, like a secret savings account?
Ooh. I wish we got that one.
Really? That's probably going to be our question for this week. But she wanted to know, should I have a get out of jail account if this relationship doesn't work out?
Hedge your bets account.
Well, we have not gotten that question, but I'd answer that twofold for, you know, whatever you would like to share. One, I'd say that to me inherently indicates a lack of trust, although that lack of trust may just be in looking out for yourself. And I understand that. But number two would be, yes. I mean, if I was in a relationship with someone, and yes, we are moving in the right direction and everything looks good and sunny, I don't see anything wrong with putting, you know, 10 or 20% to the side, because I would do that anyway. And then when we got into a fully open and committed and honest relationship, I can just roll that money in. You know, there's nothing that I need to protect myself from anymore. But to me, you know, until I think we've seen relationships not make it to, and I've been in ones where I thought we were going to make it to, you know, jumping the broom or whatever metaphor you want to use, and it didn't. So it makes sense to me.
I think so too. My mother my parents were divorced when I was 10. And I remember she was a single mom, four kids and like no money because their money was all tied up together. And I won't go into their beef, but like their business, but it was nasty and it was not good. And so she had nothing. And I want to have like an optimistic view of my relationship, but I can't, you can't untangle yourself from your childhood experiences with money. And I think what you saw in your parents and your relatives or whoever was a significant influence on you, I think that has a real impact on you. And for me, that has fed my, not obsessiveness, but my anxiety around money and my need to save and always have savings and always be like having something on the side. Cause in the back of my mind, I can't help it. It has nothing to do with my fiance. It's just, how can I ignore what might happen? And I think definitely, again, I'll go back to the years, mine and ours. I think why not have your own little bit of savings on the side? I mean, even if it's just so you can buy each other Christmas gifts and not have anyone know, you know, what you're buying. Just have your money on the side and then have something joint that you're doing together, but let it not be secret. Like, I don't think you should hold it over someone's head either.
Right.
Like, well, yeah,
the
if
other
you don't do the dishes, I'm just going to get my, you know, I have my money on the side. I'm going
to
be out of here.
I get the maid to come in because I'm balling with my 20%.
You actually just reminded me because Boobookins, as I affectionately refer to her on the show, is out of town. And you saying dishes reminded me that I need to wash these dishes after the podcast because I do not want to have that conversation tonight.
Do not let her come home to a dirty kitchen.
No, no, I do not allow it. Right now, I'm praying to the Swiffer-based gods.
I thought you were going to say you forgot to take the chicken out the freezer and she was on the way home. But, you know, yeah, like you got saved.
There's no fear. Like when your mom is like, did you remember to take the chicken out of the freezer after school? And you forgot to take the chicken out of the freezer.
And there's nothing you can do. You can try and put it in hot water and it's still just going to be frozen in the middle.
Oh, you can do some microwave, just lukewarm chicken in the microwave. That's what you do.
That sounds like bacteria.
That was me. I live to tell the tale. That's all I'm going to say.
You know, as we were walking through this conversation, because I thought I had a follow-up, but I think I answered my own question. So my follow-up question was going to be, so it sounded like you were talking about a couple who were in a relationship but not yet married. Do you think, is it more nefarious to maintain money on the side? You're side-checking when you're married?
Side-check. That's, you know.
Side-check. Yeah. Hey, write that down.
Oh, I did. Trust me.
Yeah, I'm definitely putting a little TM after that in the show notes.
You heard my voice go up. I was ready for that one.
The Marcus and Rich memoir.
Is it worse to maintain money on the side when you're okay, you are married. Now you're supposed to be, you know, open and honest and blah 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 until sickness and health until death do us part. Is it even worse then or is it all the same?
Oh, I think if you're married, absolutely. I mean, it's all back to the idea of secrecy. I don't see the need for it to be a secret. And I think if it needs to be a secret, then maybe you should examine why you're in that relationship. Is it because you're afraid they'll take it? Is it because you don't trust them that they might go spend it all or that they might come for it? You know, or I think that secrecy is not good. I don't think that you should be, again, I'll say it's all about transparency. Why, you know, just sometimes it's just a pain in the butt to merge everything. So, hey, if you got an extra $5,000 sitting in an account somewhere, but they know about it, then that it removes the threat and it keeps things honest. So yeah, I'd say that's pretty nefarious if you find out that your partner has secret money or that you feel the need to have, yeah, secret money on the side.
So I guess a caveat could be if you have money in an account like a digit and it's just pooling there and you forget about it and then you happen to look at it one day and you're like, oh yeah, I have this money here on the side, but it's my money, not our money. It's mine. It's mine.
I don't know if your partner finds out and you're like, oh, we can't possibly afford to go on this vacation. And she's like, what about that little digit account you have sitting there? What are you going to do with that? Yeah.
It's so funny you say that because I had posted about digit on Facebook and I was like, yo, just looked at my digit account for the first time in a while. I'm going to be able to fund something. And her comment was like, yay, shopping and trips with smiley faces. I was like, wait, what? That's not how I envisioned using this money at all. And it was like regular smiley face, upside down smiley face. And I'm like, all right, like we're going to have to talk about this when you get home.
That's and a conversation.
The upside down smiley face. That's a serious one right there. That's next level.
Yeah. It's like, we have this money now. What are we doing with it? Oh my God. The fights that we have about what we're going to do about this house situation, y'all. I don't even know. He wants a house. I don't want a house. And that's the big battle now. And I think, but you know, it's not a battle like negative, but it's hard. Like, what do they say about relationships? Compromise. I guess I have to learn how to do that eventually. Yeah. Financially too. Yeah, that's important, I guess.
Yeah.
So I had one comment and then maybe one follow-up comment. So I wanted to let the people feel comfortable, because I was shocked when you were like, man, we moved in so early, 2 years. I've lived with two women, and subsequently I knew one for 1 month and I knew one for 3 months.
Wow.
And I lived with both of them for multiple years.
Was it for like financial reasons?
No, it was because quickly moving reasons. So I'm impulsive every now and then, usually around women.
At least you're honest.
They mystify you.
Yeah, I'm conservative.
You're romantic, I feel like. You're romantic, right?
I try to be.
Right. Yeah. It totally can work out.
I mean, what's funny is those two relationships lasted longer than some others where, like, so some people are like, oh, you cohabitated that early in the relationship, you don't even know her. And I'm like, those two lasted longer than these two or others that I do know, and you get to know and you build up and all this other thing. So I guess it's not as easier said than done, and it can be done. I want to share that with the people out there, the fast moving individuals on the show. I didn't want them to be like, man, we moved in. Like, people side-eyeing one another like, we moved in, it was 24 hours. Didn't I meet you at the club and you was already? So I just wanted to let people know it could go either way. And then I wanted to get y'all's opinion on, I feel like one workaround, and I've done this to some degree before, was this is our money. We will have an our money account, and then you have your money account and I have my money account. And what you do with your money accounts is like your business. I don't look over there. You don't look over here. And the our money is like for joint bills. Like you said, the vacation. Isn't that a more clear workaround when established clear boundaries and lines?
Definitely. I think, I forget which one of you guys had the digit account.
That was me.
Yeah. I think the problem there is that you hadn't given that account a purpose together yet, or hadn't like assigned it a purpose. I think if you label everything and you know, everyone sort of understands, yes, this is our joint account. We use these for these things, bills, vacations, whatever. And then here's my account and here's my money. And anything I get from this will go into, you know, which of those three or four buckets. Yeah, I think that absolutely can work. It's just, don't let there just be like random income streams and not really having a label or a name or like a purpose behind them.
Yeah.
Because that'll just cause arguments.
Yeah. And that's one thing I've had to get better about. So we have our own credit cards, our own bank accounts. We have a shared bank account. And I've started to go, okay, Digit will be for this type of stuff. Well, now that I know how much is in there, this account will be for X, this account will be for Y. And I think that's just helped with planning and goals in general, just knowing kind of what some of those big picture things are, which helps keep us on track to saving more effectively, doing whatever we're supposed to do so we can hit whatever that goal is that we have attached to that particular account. I don't think either of us want to get a house right now, especially out in the Bay Area, because you can end up with something 1,000 square feet and pay like $700,000 for it, for a home. And that's like, I'm not trying to live that life. But what's interesting, jumping back to what we were talking about with moving in quickly, the first time that we actually met each other in person was the day that she moved in.
Oh.
Which of course was interesting, and I would not.
Yeah. So I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, we knew each other from the internet and from like commenting on blogs, and we had Skyped and stuff, but the first time that we actually met in person was the day that she moved in. Now,
wait a second. Your girlfriend, you didn't meet her until she moved in?
Yeah. Well, fiance now, at the time we were talking and then we started Skyping, and then she was like, oh, I'm coming to New York. And a friend was supposed to move with her, and so she was going to stay with me for a little while, then move with that friend. That friend never came. So we've been living together ever since.
The story is as old as time.
Wow.
Yeah. And looking back, I probably would not advise that, because there's a lot of conversations that we probably could have had before we made that decision, even though we initially thought it would be a temporary thing, only for it to become long time later on. But yeah, people move pretty quickly in their own ways when it comes to this relationship stuff. So
good for y'all.
So Marcus, you're not completely off there with your expedited 1 to 3 month move-in plan.
Look, my thing is, I feel like, and I felt this way at 22, but when I know, I know. So I don't need to waste time with all the niceties and getting to know you more. Like, I know myself. I know you well enough to know what I like. Like, let's get with the going. Like, I wasted enough time before I met you. I don't need to waste more. That's generally how I feel.
That's the sweetest. You should put that in your vows.
Yeah. I actually tried to jot notes so I could jack that and hope that my girl doesn't hear this so I can use it later.
Wow. Yeah. I'm glad that worked. So how old were you when you and your girlfriend, she moved in that day? like when you had just met her. Yeah, how old were you then?
However old I was in 2011. So that was 29, oh gosh, 28, 29.
Okay, well, that's different. See, I was like 23, 24 when I met. I don't know. I felt like I was too young to be rushing into like early 20s. It's different. It really depends on your age and where you're at in your life. I totally agree. You know, at a certain point, it's like, why are we wasting time? We need to get, you know, all these clocks are ticking. Like, I get it. Yeah.
Like the rabbit in Alice in Wonderland. There's clocks ticking all around you. we got time to move. I understand. So we also want to talk a little bit for the people about student loan debt. So would you ever recommend someone pay for college on credit?
Oh, is that even possible?
Oh, it's possible.
No.
It takes a lot of credit cards. Why? But it's possible.
It's definitely, you know, what I think happens is people will finance their degree with student loans and then they'll use credit cards to live on. That I totally see happening, happening. But absolutely not. I mean, just from like a mathematical standpoint, if you get federal student loans, your interest rate is going to probably be, I mean, definitely will be lower than anything you get from a credit card. So that should be your first bet. Not only is it low interest debt, you have all these flexible repayment options. So, and you'd be surprised, people don't actually max out their federal student loan debt before they go take out private debt sometimes.
What?
So you should definitely, yeah, it's true. They tend to go to private schools where they may not care so much about having this student max out their federal debt first. But absolutely, federal debt should be your first stop.
I never thought about that.
And credit cards, new.
Yeah. Yeah, the credit card thing is definitely scary. Fortunately, I did not do that. And I didn't even think about maxing out the federal debt first, but I was one of those people who thought that refund checks were just free money, not that I would have to pay it back later on. And so I'm thinking I could have paid off my student loans probably a year or two sooner had I not gotten some of those refund checks. And looking back, it was kind of crazy that the school gave it to me, because I'm sure whatever reason I provided for needing it was pretty subpar.
I don't think you even need to provide a reason, do you? They just
Well, and that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. I'm just like, yo, what did I do with that money? And I'm like, I bought snacks. Like, I went places, but I didn't do anything productive with any type of real redeeming value. I mean, maybe I may have used some of it to pay for off-campus rent, but the bulk of that money that I got in those refund checks, I have no idea what I did with it, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's, but I can't blame you. I can't blame any college student, because like, they don't send you a handbook or, you know, tell you, hey, you should maybe put that money back toward your loans at the time. But again, I don't think you should beat yourself up too hard if it was federal student loans. At the end of the day, it's better to use that than to go rack up a credit card that has like a 20% interest rate on it, you know?
Right, right.
Student loan debt is what the average rate is, like 4 to 6%, something like that, I think.
Something like that.
Yeah.
It could be worse is all I'll say. It could be worse.
Yeah.
I think it's all the way up to 8% now, if I read something recently correctly. I know mine was, no, that was a private loan. It was about 7% when I was paying back.
Federal debt now, I think, it's in the 4% range. Back in the early, if you took out student loans in the 2000s, definitely you could have that's the people who were getting their student loans refinanced, the ones who had debt back when the rates were up in 8, 9% range for federal student loan debt.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah. Nice.
So I just dated myself.
Yeah, that's my peer group. I know a lot of people who are trying to refinance their loans, or they have insane debt that I have not been able to figure out why, but it was during that time period.
Yep, it sure was. And that's the great thing about these, you know, Magnify Money. We have a page all, I mean, like that's one of our biggest, most popular pages is the student loan refinancing opportunities, like the SoFis and the Common Bonds. But these companies didn't exist until a few years ago. And they are great because they do give people access to relatively low rate loans to consolidate their private student loan debt. The sticky part is like, should I use one of these services to refinance my federal student loan debt? That can be tricky. One, you have to make sure you're actually going to get a lower rate than what your federal student loan debt is to make it actually worth it. And then when you're doing that, you have to realize that you're having them send you a check for a loan, pay off your federal student loan debts, and now you own a private loan to these companies. And with that private loan, you're losing all those federal protections and repayment plan options. And it can be less flexible if you lose a job or you can't make your minimum payments. So you have to kind of weigh the pros with the cons.
Right. So I think you clarified something for me, because we did have a listener question related to this on the Facebook page, actually. If you refinance your federal loans through a private lender, regardless of whom they may be, SoFi in this instance, then you do lose those protections when you move that money over.
Yep, you do. Because you're okay, basically, it's like they're giving you a private loan, and that has, you owe a private company versus the government. Okay. What I will say about SoFi and Common Bond, I think both of them may do this. If you lose your job and you can't pay it back, they have resources. They actually, I think I did a story about Common Bond and SoFi a few years back at Yahoo, and they actually help people find jobs. So nice. They're a little bit more friendly than like maybe a big bank, capital B bank would be. but at the end of the day, yeah, you're sort of at their mercy, definitely.
Okay, that's what I thought. And we wanted to let you know that we're going to plug this in the show notes as well. Three lies your student loan company might tell you from Magnify Money. I didn't know if there's anything that you want to expand on from that article, or you just want to refer to the article.
Oh, definitely. I think that, well, it's a lot of confusion about student loans in general. And what people don't realize is you think you can, the one person you can go to is your student loan company, like your student loan servicer, your Navient, there are like 10 or 11 of them. Mine was Mohila. And you want to go to them and say, hey.
That sounds like a drink.
Mohila, it's a real student loan servicer. And you want to go to them and say, hey, you know, I have 4, 5, 6 different student loans. By the time you graduate, because you get a new one every semester, right? So you can have 6 to 8 loans. And you're like, how do I pay these off? I can't afford the payments. And you think that they would give you the best advice. But one of the good and bad things that has happened as a result of President Obama's term, his time in office, is he did create and establish these really flexible repayment plan options, the income-based repayment plan, pay as you earn. And they're all different acronyms, but what they all kind of do is say, you earn this much, so we're going to adjust your monthly payment based on your income. And if you earn nothing, then you pay nothing, and so forth. But these student loan servicers get confused by all these different payment plans sometimes. And it can be sometimes tricky to get the right advice from them. So, yeah, I think it's important to at least educate yourself a little bit first so that you know what exactly you're asking for.
Got it.
Like, for example, some student loan servicers don't tell you that once a year, if you're enrolled in an income-driven repayment plan, you have to actually re-enroll every year. So some students think, or some graduates think, okay, I did this one time. My payments are like $32 a month. Then they're shocked when a year goes by and their payments get jacked back up to like $300 and $400. And it's because you have to actually call and put in your application again to enroll.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. Thanks.
I didn't know that. That's why. So for the post-college folks, do you have a recommendation or tip for tackling credit cards or student loan debt first? Is there an order or priority people should use?
Oh, I really hope you don't have credit card debt when you graduate. But if you do, well, first of all, if you have federal student loan debt and you have a lot of credit card debt and you can't make both payments work, then absolutely the first thing you should do is call your student loan servicer, tell them the situation and say, you know, I need to get in some sort of flexible repayment plan, get on it. And even if that means putting your loans into forbearance, and that'll give you a break. Because if you don't do that, the loans aren't going to go away. You're going to start missing your loan payments and it's going to wreck your credit before you even have a chance. I'm a good example of that. I graduated. Remember how I said I was frolicking around South America and having a great time and it all worked out? I frolicked right through November and I totally forgot that my loans had come due and all the bills were going to my parents' house.
Oh.
And I came home to like 2 missed payments and then I had $16 because I came home broke. And I missed 2 more payments because I was just too afraid to face it. And I finally called them and they're like, oh, okay, honey, we'll put it in a forbearance until you get a job. And it was fine, but those missed payments didn't go away. And it took me until this past year to see those finally drop off my credit report. So you have to, you know, face it head on. It's not like they're going to come arrest you. You just have to tell them what you're going through. And I think in most cases, your credit card debt is going to have a higher interest rate. And priority wise, that should come first because you're going to be losing more on interest by not paying that down as quickly as possible. So get your loans taken care of and lower your payments and then put everything you have into that credit card debt as fast as you can.
And I did want to clarify, although this is in the article for folks, that even in forbearance, you pointed out that debt will continue to earn interest.
Oh, yeah. Whether you're doing income driven repayment plan or you have your loans in forbearance, interest is still accruing. But again, you have to sort of take the lesser of two evils. Am I going to let my student loan debt interest accrue, which may be lower, or let my credit card interest accrue, which is probably a lot higher. It's kind of a lose-lose, but you got to take the lesser of the two evils, I guess. Let's pack as many cliches as I can into one piece of advice.
That's going to be like the highlight clip for the episode. It's just you spitting off cliches.
No, I mean, I think this is good information. I think this will help people a lot.
And so this actually reminds me of another piece that you'd written, The One Time It's Okay to Not Pay Off Debt. And I know that in the past, we've talked about dealing with debt collectors and getting the phone calls. I think you've written a few pieces about the evil debt collectors, but they'll call and say, hey, if you pay this amount today, you can pay the other amount later. But it was interesting what you said about the clock restarting. That wasn't something that I actively think about. Of course, I don't have collectors calling me, fortunately, but anything you would want to elaborate on for people who are getting called by debt collectors who are coming for something from 6-7 years ago, or let's say somebody had a phone bill or something that was in their parents' name or in a sibling's name and they didn't pay it off, and then the debt collectors are coming after you. Any advice for people who are struggling with that when they're getting those calls?
Yeah, so this article was on the topic of old debt. And what do you do when you have a debt collector calling you for a debt that you may not even remember having, or that may be so old that you're not even sure how they got their hands on it at all? And sometimes in different states, basically, at a certain point, it's no longer legal for a debt collector or lender to sue you for an unpaid debt. And that changes by state. I think it can be a couple years up to like 15 years in some states. And what happens is these debt collectors, they'll continue buying old debts from lenders because they can get it for so cheap. They just buy these huge bundles of debt. They go to Bank of America. Bank of America's like, oh man, I'll never get these, you know, this $1 million worth of student loan debt repaid. So this debt collector is like, well, I'll take off your hands for $30,000 and I'll go pursue the debts and hopefully get money back from the people and make good on my investment. And they may not even pay attention to how old that debt is. And in fact, if they may even know that it's too late for them to do anything legally to get the money back from you, but they're not going to tell you that. So they'll call you and they'll say, hey, Mr. Jones, you know, if you just make one payment of $25 today or $100 today, I'll get off your back. You know, there will be no legal repercussions. It'll be, you know, you'll just get this taken care of. And if you make that payment, and if that time clock in your state has gone by already, you're restarting the clock. And now you've given them the opportunity to potentially go after you legally in court. And that can result in having your wages garnished and all kinds of bad things. So that's what that story was about.
The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
The road to hell.
More cliches.
Definitely. And people feel guilty. They're like, man, you know, I have this old debt. Should I just pay it off? And sometimes it's not the best idea. I mean, I understand that you feel guilty and that you want to make do on the debts. And I totally believe in paying back, you know, your lenders over time. But if it's been so long and you have other newer debts or you have more financial responsibilities now than the older debts, I mean, you, at a certain point, the lender took a risk on you. That's why you pay interest. You know, they made a bad lending decision. They knew that that was possible. And that was a potential risk. And it happened. So I don't think you should feel guilty. Sometimes it's not in your best interest to, you know, settle all those old debts. And in fact, you definitely, yeah, can be hurting yourself.
Mm. Again, I'm fortunate in that regard, but I have conversations with people every now and then where they're like, yeah, or I'll see them look at their phone. And they're like, I ain't answering that. And it's to the point where they've actually put the debt collector in their phone under a name to where it says debt collector, which I'm like, at that point, you probably have a few things going on. But yeah. I just imagine the number of people who are probably like, you know what? I'm trying to get my life together. I can't pay this all off right now. So let me just make a small payment so I can, you know, start tackling this, not knowing that if they waited maybe another 6 months. So maybe it's because I think some states, what is it? Is it 7 years before they can stop coming after you? Or?
Oh, it depends by your state. Again, it's like the range is like 2 years in some states to 15 years in other states. You really have to look it up in your state and get some advice from an attorney because it's not a one blanket rule.
Okay. And so regardless, there are probably people who are at different points along that spectrum, and somebody may have seriously been 1 to 2 months from that completely falling off, and then they restart that clock thinking they're doing the right thing. So
yep.
I'm glad I stumbled across that piece, and we'll make sure that we also include that in the show notes for people who want to see a little more about that in depth.
Yeah, hopefully. And one thing I'll note real quick is if you get these letters from debt, and some people do, they have no idea where this debt's come from because it's been so long and this debt has been bought and sold by so many different third-party collectors that it may be unrecognizable. In fact, some debt collectors may not even know what the debt is themselves. They just know that they need to pursue this debt, you may be the wrong person. You may be the wrong Susan Jones in Texas, you know? So one thing you can do is request a debt verification letter from the collector. And you can easily go to consumerfinance.gov, which is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's website. Again, consumerfinance.gov. And they have these really easy sample letters that you can just copy, fill in the blanks, and send it off. And sometimes you'll send these letters off and you'll just hear silence from the debt collectors because they're like, oh, they want information we don't have. And if they don't have that information, they are actually not able to or shouldn't be pursuing that debt. So that's, yeah, one thing definitely to note.
Interesting.
Nice. And we definitely just noted that. So we're getting towards the wrap up here. Got a couple more questions we'd like to ask, though. Unfortunately, this has been a great show. If you were limited to one piece of personal finance advice or wisdom that you could share with the people, what would it be?
One piece of advice that's not spend less than you earn, because that's really just the key to everything.
That's actually an excellent one.
Spend less than you
earn. It's actually also one of the hardest ones.
It is. It's like eat less than you work out. It's like the weight loss thing. It's it's the simplest and most difficult piece of advice to follow. But if you can just spend less than you earn, then you will be golden.
Nice, nice. And I think that's accurate. I do definitely support that. I support it existentially because it is very difficult to do. So is there any social media or upcoming projects that you want to share? We talked a little bit about Magnify Money and the Brown Ambition podcast. Do you want to expand on those a little bit?
Yeah, I'll tell you about Magnify Money. It's an amazing site run by two college friends who were both from the different sides of the banking industry. One was a Goldman Sachs analyst. The other one ran the consumer unit for the UK's Barclays card for like 15 years. And they came together and wanted to create a destination for anyone looking for a transparent and easy to understand tools and explainers and reviews for things like credit cards and savings accounts and checking accounts. And that's what they created. And I joined Magnify Money last year to bring my skills as a journalist and telling consumer stories, you know, with their support, and which has been a privilege and a lot of fun for me just to get to write stories that have an impact and tell stories that have an impact and expose like the types of challenges people are facing in their everyday lives. So you can find that at magnifymoney.com. And yeah, the podcast run by me and my co-host Tiffany, the Budgetista Alice. We've been at it for over a year now, and it's been really fun. We talk about some things that are not money related for sure, but we try and keep it about career and finance. But just, you know, I think just like you guys do, just have some fun with it. I think people take money really seriously. It does not have to be that bad. Mm-hmm. It can be fun, and you have to just sort of have a lighthearted approach to it. And that's what we try to do on Brown Ambition. We have some cool guests coming up. We have Miko Branch, for the founder of Miss Jessie's. She's going to come on the podcast, talk about building her hair care brand. And yeah, it's a fun little side project. And you can check out the brownambitionpodcast.com. We're on Twitter at the BA podcast and magnifymoney.com. And you can find us on Twitter at magnify_money.
Awesome. Awesome. And I heard you all on a podcast over on Stacking Benjamins. I want to say it was probably a couple months ago. I know Tiffany was on it. You were on it. The gentleman from Magnify Money was on it. And it was a super insightful episode. I actually had to email Joe, Average Joe Money, who's the host of the podcast, and be like, yo, this episode was dope. And I've noticed in particular with Brown Ambition, it seems like y'all have really been taking off in the past few months, at least in iTunes. And, you know, it looks like you've had a ton of reviews that have come in. So have you all done anything differently recently that you think is helping with the rise of the podcast, or is it just really being consistent that's really kind of helped you all take off?
Well, first of all, I got to give a shout out to iTunes because they actually created that category on the main page for a long time called Black Voices in Business. And I think you guys were featured there. We were featured there. So that definitely helped boost us in the last fall. But I mean, you can't deny the power of the New Year's resolutions. And I don't know if you guys saw an uptick in January, but I mean, after the new year, our audience just exploded. And I think that has to do with a lot with just that time of year. People are trying to do right financially. And luckily, we were in the right place and they found our show. And I mean, I've been looking at our traffic. And I think the best thing about our show is that our audience is loyal. Like once you start listening to us, I think you get really invested because we do open up so much about our own personal lives. And when we have an off week, I have fans who are tweeting at me and emailing me like, what are we going to do? What's happening with Tiffany's home buying purchase and your wedding's coming up? And yeah, we try and just keep it fun and recognize that personal finance doesn't have to be this big, scary topic. And you can talk about you know, the Oscars and politics and all this stuff happening outside of finance and then always bring it back. Because I think that's just human nature. You know, you're never just on one sort of track. You're like dealing with a bunch of different issues all at one time. And sort of we talk about that and talk about how money and career plays into all the different aspects of our life. And I can't thank our audience enough, definitely, for the support.
Music to my ears to hear that in terms of the topics, in terms of everything, really. I feel like we really are some type of like podcast, internet, personal finance, career, twins, somehow. Some type of ally network. But yeah, this has been an awesome conversation. It's funny, as we were talking, you would keep saying stuff. And of course, we had an agenda in terms of what we wanted to cover. But you would say something and I'd be like, oh, I have a thought about that. And so throughout the show.
I talk a lot. Sorry about that.
It's good, though. And I think for everyone listening, I'm sure that they got a similar sense from listening to this episode. So, Mandy, I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been awesome having you with us.
Thank you guys so much. It's so nice to talk to you. I'm a big fan, and I do feel like we're allies, and you have our support. Found Ambition totally endorses Paychecks and Balances. We'll have you guys on our show sometime too. Yeah, for sure.
Fist in the air. So, of course, we want to thank everyone for listening to this episode. Don't forget to join our email list, where we share helpful stories we read throughout the week, actionable work and money tips, and more. You can sign up by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email.
And if you've been enjoying the show, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, if you want to pronounce it correctly. And if you don't know how, visit paychecksandbalances.com/review.
There it is. So again, we want to thank everyone for listening. Thanks again to a great guest. And until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.